Hello, everybody. This is Art Cippo.
And Rick Croxton.
And you're in the Book Cave. We have a very special show for you tonight. Our guests are the guys that I call the Four Horsemen of PharmaCon. We have Mike Croteau, Paul Spiteri, Chris Carey, and last but not least, Wynn Eckert. These are the gentlemen who have been the heart and soul behind the Philip Farmer Convention that's been held for the last several years. And they also have been involved with developing some of the materials that Phil had in his magic filing cabinet and having it printed. And we'd like to welcome them all. Mike, how you doing?
I'm great, Art. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Paul, how's it doing over there in England?
Very well, thank you. For a change, it's nice and sunny over here. Not that I can tell at this time of the morning, but we're doing good over here. Thank you.
Yeah. It's only about, what, 2:30 or so, something like that?
Coming up to 3 a.m. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. All right, and this, Chris, how's it out there in Washington?
Oh, it's probably cooler than just about everywhere else for everybody on the line here.
Yeah, I know it's 100 degrees out here in St. Louis. Man, yeah. What a day. And then, Wynn, you're up there in the Mile High City.
Mile High City, we've got probably upper 70s or 80s today, which is nice change from the upper 90s and 100s we've been having.
Amen. Oh, wow. I'm envious. I tell you, this heat is just crazy down here. Well, anyway, we have lots of things to talk about. There are, there's a history behind PharmaCon. There's a history of you guys and how you came together and met Phil and got involved in working with him and with his material. And then there are projects that have been completed, projects in the future. We've got lots of things that people are going to be interested in hearing about. We also want to talk a little bit about the very recent PharmaCon that we had up there in Seattle in conjunction with Locus Magazine. So why don't we get started? Mike, you're the grand old man when it comes to PharmaCon. Why don't you go ahead and give us a little history on how PharmaCon got started?
Sure, okay, I'd love to. Actually, the first, almost what I'd call the first PharmaCons weren't called PharmaCons. In 2001, when Phil won the Grand Master Award, the Peoria Public Library decided to have a living legend reception for him. And this wasn't the first thing they'd done for him. Phil was very well known in Peoria with the people at the library and the newspaper, although Phil used to joke he was better known in France than in his hometown. and that may be true, but they did know who he was. So after Phil won the Grand Master Award in 2001, the head of public relations at the library, a lady named Maggie Nelson, called me and asked me if I'd be interested in coming up there and if I could advertise the event on the website I was doing, the unofficial website I was doing back then. And that was kind of the genesis of it. I got a whole bunch of people to travel from. In fact, I think Chris Carey was there. He came from Washington State, and people came from Texas. I know some people came from California, from the Northeast. I came from Atlanta. And we had the event at the library, which I had nothing to do with. There was a lady there from the mayor's office and another lady there from a state representative's office, and they had declared it Philip Jose Farmer Day and all these kinds of things. And the plan was to have an hour of people talking and then an hour or so of Phil doing a book signing. And then Phil and Betty, his wife, were going to go home and rest for a few hours, and then we were going to meet for dinner. And Betty, before she left, said, "Well, what are you guys doing for the next 2 or 3 hours? And I said, "Absolutely nothing. We're just going to hang out here at the library or hang out at the hotels." And Betty said, "Oh, why don't you just have everybody come over to the house?" This was like 20 people that I knew specifically who were going to dinner that night. So I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Oh, yes, absolutely." And we all went over to the house and hung out in the basement and watched a videotape of Phil winning the Grand Master Award and his acceptance speech and got to drool over his paintings and his books and everything. And then we all went out to dinner. And that, again, was in 2001. And the following year, Betty said, that was so much fun, we've got to do it again. And I said, well, they're not going to give them a Grandmaster Award again this year. But we thought about it and realized that this was 2002. It was the 50th anniversary of the Lovers. So I contacted the library, and they loved the idea, and we basically had a 50th anniversary celebration of the Lovers. And a guy named Tracy Knight, a very good writer, contacted a whole bunch of people and got them to send letters to Phil. And when I say a whole bunch of people, I mean, I've got the program here. Gene Wolfe, Jane Yolen, Joe Haldeman, Piers Anthony, Robert Sheckley, Bruce Sterling, David Brin, Ed Gorman, Joe Hensley, David Drake, Gene M. All, of all people, Julian May, Fred Pohl, Michael Bishop, Andre Norton, Kim Stanley Robinson, Michael Moorcock, James Gunn, Howard V. Hendricks, and Kilgore Trout all sent letters to Phil congratulating him on the 50th anniversary, and we printed this up in programs and gave them out, and that was in August 2002. And then we didn't do it again. We sort of ran out of ideas, and Betty kept bugging me about it. And so I said, you know, we don't have the Neb, we don't have the Grandmaster, we don't have the 50th anniversary of anything. And she said, I don't care. Just think of an excuse. We're having a party. So we called it FarmerCon, and we've now done 5 of them. And the tradition always was, since Betty invited us over that first time, was we did something at the library. We went out to eat, and then it became Sunday afternoons. We all spent at Phil's house having a picnic, having food laid out in the basement and hanging out in the backyard. And it was just a real treat for fans to get to meet their idol. And Phil and Betty, you know, liked having parties. They didn't travel anymore. They didn't go to conventions like they did for 50 years. So this was the convention coming to them. And this past year, this was kind of always in our heads, is that, you know, we wanted to continue doing FarmerCon into the future, kind of like the Edgar Rice Burroughs fans have Dum Dums every year. This is our version of that. And I'm sure I forgot something important here. One thing is Paul Spiteri was kind of instrumental in getting that first FarmerCon going after the 2 library events. He and Betty used to conspire together to do things like this, so we'll see if he has any details. I forgot.
Not off the top of my head, but yeah, I mean, you know, how I came into this, if now's a good time to talk about it, is, you know, I was just a fan in the UK who never thought I'd meet up with, you know, my literary hero. And I became friendly with Tracy Knight quite independently. And, you know, I can remember being blown away when I mentioned I was a fan of Phil Farm, and he said, well, I was at a signing with him just, you know, a few weeks ago. And when I first came over to the States it was in 2000, and I met up with Tracy. We talked about meeting up with Phil, but that didn't work. But the next year in 2001, did manage to meet up with Phil. It was actually on the date of his 60th wedding anniversary to Betty. And, you know, it was great. He was just so welcoming, and, you know, I was there with my family, and we spent some great time. And, you know, we just got on so well, and the next year we were back. And as Mike said, you know, things just kind of rolled on from there. And, you know, yeah, it was great. And me and Betty used to talk all the time, particularly, you know, had a great friendship with both of them, but I think perhaps more so with Betty over the years. And we used to talk, and we used to plan things, and, you know, it was good. They were good times. Do you want me to talk a little bit more about things that I've been involved in? I mean, I think probably the thing I am very proud of is obviously editing Pearls of Peoria. And I think that came out in 2006. I mean, a lot of work done by Mike and other guys as well to put that together. But, yeah, that was a good volume of of work of Phil's, some quite rare stuff that I think was hard to get hold of, and so very pleased that was out there for people to enjoy. And, you know, after that, I completed a short story that Phil had started many years before called Getting Ready to Write, and we talked about that, and I completed that story, and that was published in one of the Pharma Files. I can't remember exactly which one, but one of them, and following on from that, I wrote the Time Distorter story based on Phil's adventures himself, and latterly, I've got a story in the world of Philip Jose Pharma Protein Dimensions called Le Maréchal, which I'm sure we'll get on to eventually as well.
Very good.
Yeah, go ahead, Art.
No, I was going to say now, how many volumes of material have you all published? You know, this is with Subterranean Press. There were several volumes that have been published that you guys have helped with. What are those volumes? What's in them?
Well, I think Pearl from Peoria was the first sub-press. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was The Best of Philip Jose Pharma, wasn't it? It was the first sub-press anthology, followed by Pearl from Peoria.
I had a little bit to do with that, not as much as with the later volumes, but William Schaefer, the publisher at Subterranean Press, contacted me because I was basically the only presence Phil had online, and sent me a very short email saying he'd be interested in doing a collection of Farmer. Who is Farmer's agent? Could you please put me in touch with him? And I sent him back probably a 5,000-word email talking about how much I already knew what Subpress was. I love their books. They do great books. And I've got all these ideas for Farmer collections, and here they are. And I'm sure I scared the guy half to death. But he did. He was nice enough to ask me to write the afterword to The Best of Philip Jose Pharma. And in all that time of stalling, I just brought up their list online. Of course, Pearls from Peoria was the next one. That was originally with another publisher, which fell through. And Subterranean Press snapped up really quickly. I guess Up from the Bottomless Pit and Other Stories was the third one, and that was basically everything Phil wrote in the first 10 issues of Pharma File, the magazine that we all worked on. And Chris Carey edited that one, as he also edited Venus on the Half Shell and others, and The Other in the Mirror. And then, of course, there's Phil's novel, finished by Wynne, The Evil in Pemberley House. So, yeah, Subterranean Press has published quite a bit of Phil, and there's another one forthcoming, Up the Bright River, which is kind of amazing when you look at how many short story collections they've already done. And Pearls from Peoria is a big 800-page book, and there's still so much great stuff in this collection that's coming up at the end of this year. And I started to say a minute ago that the Peoria Library has done a lot of things with Phil. And, in fact, Paul mentioned when he first met Phil through Tracy. As far as I know, the first time Chris met Phil was also at a library-sponsored event. So maybe that would be a good time for him to pick that story up.
Yeah, I met Phil first back in 1998, and in June, I believe it was June of 1998, and we had briefly corresponded before in regards to a kind of Wold Newton-esque article that I had written on his work, which kind of intrigued Phil. And so when I met him, I introduced myself as the fellow who had written that, and I didn't really know his I could guess it from his writing, but I didn't know personally his very sly wit, so he looks at me and says, "Oh, you're that guy," because I had proposed some very very controversial theories in that article, and but he was just kidding around. For a second my heart stopped, and then he thrust out his hand and gave me a big warm smile. So, But yeah, there was an event at the Peoria Library there. I believe it was called Philip is a Farmer Odyssey. And it was basically a kind of like a museum display of farmerian treasures, things that were basically from Phil's house, like the I don't know if you've seen the cover of the book of Philip is a Farmer, the Berkeley edition, where Phil's sitting at his typewriter with Tarzan on his shoulder. And they had the original painting of that there, and like a chart of the Wald Newton family, and all sorts of magazine covers from his various publications. And he gave a talk on, that was at the time that Nothing Burns in Hell was coming out, and he gave a nice talk on that. But I first got into Phil, well, I got into him back in the early 80s when I, at the same time I was reading Edgar Rice Burroughs, and by the time the 90s rolled around, I had started writing some articles about him, basically revolving around his Wald Newton theories, and started getting those published in some fanzines and things like that. And that's kind of how I met Phil, because I sent him one of my articles for his comments. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard from a lot of people that Phil was always very gracious to young writers, and he really did appreciate the fans, and seemed to enjoy having them around. And I think Betty kind of helped along a little bit too, didn't she?
Didn't oh, absolutely. Yeah. She made everyone feel welcome every year, and was very anxious to have us back. She couldn't wait till the next FarmerCon gathering to come along.
I mean, I used to speak to Betty quite often, and we used to spend 6 months planning the next one, and then the next 6 months talking about the one that had just happened. So it was a constant topic of conversation. So, yeah, she did love it.
Oh, that's great. Well, now, the materials that you folks have published with Subterranean, a lot of them come from the Magic Filing Cabinet. Why don't you tell us what the Magic Filing Cabinet is?
I think you can take that one, Mike.
Okay. Yeah, there's actually more than we refer to it as the Magic Filing Cabinet. There was actually four rows. There's four filing cabinets in Phil's basement. And a lot of it was, you know, personal stuff and genealogy. Phil was very into genealogy and traced back his ancestry, I think, all the way back to Odin. But there's a lot of material that he wrote that was never published. A lot of mainstream stories that, you know, he was sending out before he tried his hand at science fiction that just didn't get sold. And eventually he showed me these, and the first time I he was kind of surprised I wanted to read them, which, you know, shocked me, because clearly, I mean, he's my favorite author. Of course I want to read, you know, anything he's written. So he let me read them, and I said, you know, I know other fans who would love to read these. Why don't we sell photocopies of these manuscripts on the website? And so we did that with the first seven or eight, and some of them were even incomplete novels. It was just the first five chapters and then an outline. And for $150 or whatever, you could buy a copy of that and read it yourself. And then we did that for a while, and as those stories were ending up in Pearls from Peoria, I found a whole nother batch. And enough material that we plan to do 10 issues of Farmer File, the magazine of Philip Jose Farmer, based around those, including a novel, Up from the Bottomless Pit, a very timely novel these days.
Yes.
it being about an offshore oil well where the rig explodes and it's running, you know, uncontrollably spilling millions of gallons of oil into the ocean. Phil set it off the coast of California and had fun describing Los Angeles being burned to the ground. Let's see, but you know, the most amazing thing about it is that every time I would go back to Peoria, I would look again and I would find something new. And luckily, I am now currently the holder of the Magic filing cabinet. I'm trying to sort it and do some sort of archive, and we're getting material from it now for the Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, which we'll talk about later. And eventually these files will go to a university, which is normally what happens with an author like Phil. But in the meantime, his heirs are letting me go through them and try to find material to use and what have you. And interestingly enough, I think, I'm not sure of this, but I think the first time that Wynn actually met Phil, he came to Peoria and helped me go through the Magic filing cabinet.
Yeah, Mike, that's actually right. Phil and Betty were extremely gracious in allowing a first-time visitor to go down into the depths of the basement with you and look through the cabinet. It still is the date I will never forget. It was July 4th, 2005. And, Mike, I think you emailed me or called me maybe a week and a half or 2 weeks before then and said, hey, I'm going up to Peoria on the spur of the moment, and do you want to come? And I kind of dropped everything because I had never had a chance to be out there before that. You guys had all gone out and met Phil long before I had the chance to do so. So I was the latecomer. And I said, yeah, I dropped everything. And I think I flew out on a Friday night, and we stayed over, and I flew home the next day. Anyway, we got there. That was the first time I had met Mike. We went to Phil and Betty's house. They were extremely gracious, as everyone has described. And that night after, we were all done talking and sort of visiting and so forth, they said, yeah, sure, you can go down with Mike. Mike had gone to look through the Magic filing cabinet and try to get some more material for Farmer File. And so I went down and helped Mike out, and we looked through files and sorted things out and so forth, and that was a pretty momentous visit from my perspective. I found a file there, which eventually turned into a completed novel. So that was, right from my very first visit, finding a file and an incomplete manuscript and an outline, to working, researching, and bringing a proposal back to Phil and Betty, who, again, were very receptive to a first-time novelist, proposing something which probably, seems pretty audacious to go and propose to Philip Jose Farmer that you're going to finish one of his novels that he never completed. But they were extremely receptive and very pleased about that. And that became the book, The Evil in Pemberley House, which was one of the Subterranean Press titles that you guys mentioned earlier.
Now, Wayne, you said that was the first time you and I had met, and that's true, and the first time you'd met Phil, but obviously they'd had a lot of contact with you before this, because Myths for the Modern Age had already come out, had it not?
That's true. So that's Myths for the Modern Age, Philip Jose Farmer's Wold Newton Universe. Actually, if that was July 2005, Myths didn't come out until November.
Okay, but you were like working on it.
But it was. I was working on it. It was in progress. So they definitely knew I was working on the book and putting together that collection. So that was a collection from Monkey Brain Books, which brought together all of Phil's, or at least all of Phil's known at that time, Wold Newton articles that he wrote for various publications over the years regarding the Wold Newton family, sort of the shared universe of pulp heroes and detectives and adventurers and evil masterminds that Phil proposed were all part of the same family or the same world. So I brought together his known articles in that genre, and then brought in some other writers who had written some very nice essays in the same vein and brought that together as a collection, and that came out for Monkey Brain. So, yeah, definitely Phil and Betty knew who I was. I had spoken with Phil and Betty on the phone briefly, I think, earlier that year or the prior year. So, yeah, but that was definitely the first time, though, that I got to meet them in person.
Now, of course, you've been knocking around with Will Newton material for a long time now, Wynn, because I knew you, gosh, when did we start corresponding about Will Newton? About what time frame was that? That was in the 90s.
It was. I want to say you were probably one of the people that wrote me pretty early on, Art, that emailed me. So I put the website on, the Will Newton Universe, or an expansion of Philip Jose Farmer's Will Newton Universe website. That went up in August of 1997. And I would say, you know, probably within a year, you had written to me, Art. And I think one of the very first things, and correct my recollection if I'm wrong, one of the very first things you had proposed was perhaps some sort of connection between Pat Savage, Doc Savage's cousin, between Pat Savage and the Baroness.
Yes.
A series of sort of almost like a female James Bond, 8 paperbacks that came out in the 1970s. Very racy books, very pulpy in terms of how they were written. And I had never heard of the Baroness, but actually ended up several years later seeking them out based on your recommendation, Art.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed you also included a reference to the Baroness in Pemberley House too.
I did, Art. That was a tip of the hat. I wanted to acknowledge that connection in obviously a very distant way, but definitely wanted to acknowledge that.
That's super.
So you guys got me kind of curious, though. What is the connection between the two?
Well. So it gets a little bit complex to explain, but essentially, Phil was well known for dropping crossover references in his work, or at least in some of his works. So references to other fictional characters from other series, and if you believe the reference, then you can sort of extrapolate or pretend that these two characters exist in the same world. And I carried that forward in Pemberley House and dropped a very subtle reference to the world of the Baroness in the Evil of Pemberley House. And to say any more than that, I won't point to the exact reference.
Right.
But obviously Art picked it up.
Oh, yeah. You know, and that was part of the fun, is that actually the Pemberley House adventure occurred in the 1970s, which is also around the time that the Baroness's stories were being told. So it's not unusual that they would might have a little connection there, at least in time.
Yeah, and I think there was also just a connection between you know, that and the parallel themes of a strong female character, a strong female character who has an active sex life and so forth. Although I don't think that I set out to write Pemberley House in sort of the same pulp style that the Baroness was written in. That probably would have been going a little bit too far.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I've got like one copy and one issue, one book of the Baroness, so I know who you're talking about. You know, it's a very hard series to come by. Like you said, there's only 8 books and...
I think the later paperbacks are a little bit more rare as well. At least the first 3 or 4 were published jointly in the U.S. and the U.K. And there was a total of 8 altogether. Actually, take that back, because I just learned pretty recently that there was actually a 9th, and there's a Yahoo discussion group on the Baroness that discussed this 9th book quite often, and they all knew it was written, but it was never published. And come to find out, it actually was published, but only in France.
Yeah.
Now, she's kind of similar in a way to Modesty Blaise.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah.
So that way, that kind of gives people a little reference point of who she is.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the interesting things that I've been learning in recent years, is how many of these characters that came from American and some of the British literature actually were published in other editions in different countries. You mentioned the Baroness. There was the Black Bat, I believe, continued to be published for another 20 years or so after it stopped publication in the U.S. They published them in German with original stories. And I've come to understand that there were at least two other series. I was just reading something about this, that very similarly, there are more books available in French, and I think one is in German. I'm trying to remember what the series are, but I'm blanking. So this, you know, that's very interesting. It seems that a lot of American fictional characters are taken and used elsewhere. People put them into their own languages, and sometimes they take on a life of their own. But
that's true, Art. And as long as we're talking about sort of the internationalization of books or characters, you know, it's probably worth noting, you know. And I think as Mike noted earlier, Phil thought he was probably, you know, more famous or more loved in France than in Peoria. If you all ever have a chance, Google the Philip Jose Farmer International Bibliography site. It's another fantastic site that basically lists as many of the foreign editions as you could possibly hope to see, all the way from French and Italian to Russian and Turkish and Czechoslovakian. And you know, it's possible that there are even some French versions of Phil's books that may contain some material that actually was excised from some of the U.S. or U.K. editions.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember that Hans Kiso was talking about that at the convention. Hans is from Denmark, and he and his wife have been at all the farmer cons that I've been to now. And it would be interesting, you know, someday to have somebody go and look at that. Because, you know, as we all know, when you send a manuscript to the publisher, they have editors, and the editors go back and forth. And sometimes the original publishing manuscript might be sent to the translator with material in that was left out from the American edition, and it could find its way in. My understanding from Hans is there may be extra material in A Feast Unknown. Were there any? I'm trying to remember if there was some
Mike
of the other books.
Mike or Paul or Chris, I think there was one other that, and again, we don't know for sure, but we suspect.
Yeah,
we haven't confirmed.
Hans had originally thought that there was some extra material in Flesh. So far, we haven't been able to confirm that. He had sent me some of the storyline that he thought wasn't in there, but I think I've identified that in it. So I'm not 100% convinced that there is new material in Flesh, but it's possible.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's interesting, because if you do go to the French version of Amazon.com, they have some unusual books about Philip Jose Farmer, including one about Philip Jose Farmer conquering the universe, if I remember.
Mike or Paul, you want to take that one?
I'm trying to think of the name of the guy. It's a French author, Mottier, who wrote a story with Phil as the protagonist. That's right, isn't it, Mike?
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't read the book myself, so I can't comment on it on its content. But it hasn't
been published in English.
Yeah, my French, I could probably just about get through it, but it would take a bit of a slog to read it in French, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and for FarmerCon 4, in the program, we actually published an English translation of Phil's foreword to the book. So he wrote it in English, it got transferred into French, and then Phil's son, Philip Laird Farmer, actually translated it back to English for me. And, of course, right after we published that, I found Phil's original English version of it. So he did all that work for nothing, because we did find it. But yeah, the cover for FarmerCon 4 is actually a scene from the book where the author describes. Now, this is set in the far future, after you know, hundreds of years in the future, and there's a statue, a bust of Phil's head in a park in Peoria, and pilgrims come from all over the world and place gold foil leaf on it. And what happens in the story, and I don't know the whole story, I just know the beginning of it, is a ship crashes into it, and witnesses who saw that said it looked like a puff of smoke came out of the statue. And that puff of smoke was basically Phil's soul, and it goes off to other planets and has adventures. Takes, you know, reanimates itself, ends up in a body, and Phil has adventures, which I'm not sure if I can say this on the podcast or not. I asked Phil about the book, if he liked it, and he said, yeah, I liked most of it, except for the part where where he gets, well, do you remember the scene
in A Feast Unknown?
A Feast Unknown, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe we can.
Yeah. Tied up.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Where our body is yeah, perpetrated on him. That's, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Leave it at that.
Obviously, that book was written after A Feast Unknown, and the author turned the tables on Phil a little bit. But Phil gave permission for the book. Like I said, he wrote a foreword to it and was fully involved with it. And apparently somebody did want to translate it into English, but they weren't happy with the translation and sent it to Phil for him to retranslate, but he never got around to it. He just had too many other projects happening.
Yeah. And now Phil did do some translation from French. He did one of the Rosny novels that he entitled Iron Castle. And to my knowledge, that's the only book that we know Phil actually translated from the French. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Right. In fact, I just read the new Brian Stableford translation of Rosny's text, which was a very interesting experience to compare and contrast it with Phil's version. Notably, the first and last chapter are mostly Phil's. The first chapter is of Phil's version is all of Phil, and the last chapter is kind of a bit of a fusion, if I'm not mistaken, of Phil and Rosny. And there are little tweakings of language throughout, and a little bit of some character differences too. Put in for the character that Phil called Sir George Curtis, who was the nephew, I believe, of Sir Henry Curtis from H. Rider Haggard's King Solomon's Mines. Rosny's character was not a Wold Newton family member like that. He was actually, I believe, Sir George Farnham, I believe, was the name that Rosny had called him. So some interesting differences there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know this was, Phil had done this in the middle of his pulp period, and when he was very heavily involved with Wold Newton work, so I'm not surprised he put a few little things in there to link up. It was a fun book when he translated. I've only just gotten a copy of the new version by Brian Stableford. I'm looking forward to reading it, and again, as you said, contrasting it. Rosny is probably best known in this country. He was the author of the novel that was the basis for the movie Quest for Fire. That was way back in the 19s. That was in the late 1970s. Not that long ago for some of us.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, I was a young man back in the 70s.
Yeah. We were all sort of young back in the 70s. Some of us were much younger than others.
Very true, Art. Very true.
I will say that having read both the Stableford version of Iron Castle and the Farmer version, I believe Phil was very respectful of Rosny's text. He really tried to translate it as accurately as possible, and then he, I believe, tried to spruce up the text a little bit for perhaps for the modern audience. But I think even when he did that, when he changed the text and added a paragraph here or there, he was very, very respectful. Both translations are a great read. So I highly recommend it, picking up the Black Coat version maybe first and seeing how Rosny actually wrote it, and then going to see how Phil kind of tweaked it a little bit.
Probably for most of us, that's not possible since for the audience, absolutely.
For the uninitiated.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got the Black Coat version as well, but have not had a chance to read it yet, as with so many books in my pile.
Yeah. And equally, I think people who've read the Farmer version would really enjoy going to see what was done differently. There are more things than I've mentioned there, so it's quite interesting.
Well, now, we know, Wynn, you had done the Pemberley House novel, which was very well received. It was a great read, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of little Wold Newton connections in there, too. There were also two other novels that were completed in collaboration with Phil before his death. One of them was a Western. What was the title of the Western? I always forget.
No, there was a Western that was going to be completed, but it wasn't.
Oh, it did not get completed. Oh, okay.
Right. There's The City Beyond Play.
Right.
Danny Adams, Phil's nephew, completed. And that's a really fun book. It's a short book. It's a novella. It was published by PS Publishing. And it's more or less, it's set in the future. I forget specifically how far, say 100 years in the future, where a society, basically the same crowd you would meet at your nearby Renaissance festival, has permanently built up this valley and sort of has a legal residence there. And if you go live there, you play the game 24/7. So you come in as a serf and you can work your way up to nobility and whatnot. And that's where it's set. And there's a guy, a fugitive running from the law. It's almost like going to a different country, going in there. And he sneaks off into there, and that's where he's hiding out. And it was a lot of fun. Phil wrote the first, I don't know, three or four chapters, and then left a pretty detailed outline of the rest. And Danny Adams did a really good job finishing that novel. That was a lot of fun to read.
He did. I actually have the original outline that Phil had. And after I read the collaboration, how Danny finished it, I went back and reread the outline, and it was amazing how close he kept to Phil's vision for that short novel. So very, very good job, I thought. Yeah, it's still available, I believe. Is that correct? There are still some copies that PS Publishing has in stock?
They actually sold out at one point, and then, like, got some returns from some of their bigger bookstores, and so they were back in stock, and I'm not sure if they still are, because that was a couple months ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, it might still be available, and definitely worth picking up.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, now, there was another novel, and that was one that you were involved with, Chris, wasn't it?
You're speaking of The Song of Kwasin?
Yes. Yes, that takes place in the ancient world. It really it's interesting because Phil had done two novels that were set in the ancient past and were trying to deal with explaining where the old cities that you find in H. Rider Haggard stories and in some of the Tarzan stories came from. And this was the Kokarsan Empire. Can you talk a little bit about the Kokarsan books?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It really originates with an Edgar Rice Burroughs fan named Frank J. Breukel, B-R-U-E-C-K-E-L. I assume I'm pronouncing it correct. correctly, who way back, I believe it was in 1939, he had written a letter to Edgar Rice Burroughs proposing that, I believe this was after Jane had been killed off in the series, and he was proposing that that must have been quite a while afterwards, but I assume he wanted Tarzan to move on from Jane for some reason or other, but he wanted Tarzan basically to become involved with someone from the mother culture of the lost city of Opar, which was introduced into the Tarzan series in the book The Return of Tarzan, and then later appeared in a few other Tarzan novels, Tarzan and the Jewels of Opar, Tarzan and the Golden Lion, and Tarzan the Invincible, and also had a brief mention in one of the Tarzan twin stories. And so Breukel had written to Edgar Rice Burroughs proposing that that Tarzan get together with someone from this ancestry, from the mother culture of Opar, which Burroughs at first didn't specify what the mother culture of this lost city was. Then later he slipped in references to it being Atlantean. These Burroughs scholars, Frank Breukel and John Harwood later, who collaborated with Breukel, came along and didn't quite buy the Atlantean thing, or they didn't think that it was referring to the same Atlantis, the Atlantis from Plato's Atlantis that was situated beyond the Pillars of Hercules in the Atlantic Ocean. So they believed that the mother culture must have been, just from the way that Burroughs described the geography, must have been somewhere in Africa. Beginning with Breukel, kind of fixated on this idea that in around the turn of the Ice Age or so, there was this great landlocked sea in the middle of Africa that has been referred to as the Chad Sea, and or the Congo Sea, sometimes also called. And so he wrote to Burroughs and kind of proposed this idea that there really was this other mother culture for Opar, and perhaps Tarzan could meet some love interest from that descendant from that culture, with the Atlantean blood. And Burroughs' secretary, C.R. Rothman, wrote back to Frank Breukel and said, sorry, we can't, we have a policy of not passing on any fan letters with plot suggestions in them because we could get sued. So the letter went unread by Edgar Rice Burroughs. And so throughout the years, I guess Breukel kind of continued to stew on this idea, and eventually he started collaborating with another Burroughs fan I mentioned before, John Harwood, and they wrote kind of a monograph on the idea called Heritage of the Flaming God, which Phil read in manuscript form. It was supposed to be lined up to be printed in the Burroughs Bulletin in the early 1970s, but that never came to happen. And Phil became very smitten by this same idea, and basically Breukel and Harwood interrelated all the cities from Tarzan's Africa. Phil took it a step further and added in a lot of references to H. Rider Haggard. For instance, the city of Wentusa in the Kokarsa books, or Opar books, ancient Opar books, is actually, if you invert the syllables, it would be Sawentis, which is basically turned into the word, according to Farmer, Zuvendis, which fans of H. Rider Haggard should recognize from the Alan Quatermain novels. And so Phil pitched the idea of writing a series of his own, using this as a springboard. Nothing very overt was used in the stories, except for the name Opar and some sly references. And for instance, when they actually go to Opar in the second book, when Hadon actually makes it back to Opar, they travel through a series of tunnels, which, if you've read The Return of Tarzan, you'll recognize as the same tunnels that Edgar Rice Burroughs described. But other than that, he really went whole hog and created his own vision of this prehistoric civilization in the heart of Africa. That's the basis for mm-hmm. for the series.
Okay, and then now Song of Kwasan, which is the novel that you and Phil collaborated on. Can you tell us a little something about what the story is there?
Yeah, well, the manuscript and outline to the Song of Kwasan, which was originally called Kwasan of Opar, but the title was we decided to change the title. Phil had always had a problem with that title, which was proposed to him by Donald Bolheim back when the series was being published by Daw Books. Phil had a problem with Opar in the title because Kwasan wasn't from Opar. He was from the city of Dithbeth. So actually it's probably pronounced Dithbeth, but I have Phyllis Cocarson's syllabary, which explains how the syllables are pronounced. A lot of the fans and readers, myself included, mispronounce a lot of the words a lot, such as it would actually be the Song of Kwasin, and it would be pronounced Hadon of Ancient Opar. Interesting little tidbits, but sorry, I'm getting sidetracked there.
Yeah, well, we should say that I remember at the convention we had some of the material you were showing that Phil had compiled for the Cocarson language. It was very detailed. He actually meant it to be a non-Indo-European language, and he was getting etymologies for the words. It really was. You can see the master at work and the detail he put into the background.
Yes, Phil was an amateur linguist. He had actually studied linguistics formally at a master's level. He didn't get a degree in it, but he took quite a bit of linguistics classes and coursework. So he really, it's quite intensive. And later I actually found, this would have been in January 2009 when I joined a small group of people for Phil's, out in Peoria to visit Phil and Betty for Phil's Phil's birthday, right before he passed away, actually, in January 2009. Paul and I were actually looking through the files, and we discovered another Cocarsa folder, much to my surprise. It was called Cocarsa Lore, was the title of the folder, which very much intrigued me. And in it was several drafts of an what would have probably been an addendum to one of the Opar novels, which goes into great detail about the language. And I had had a handwritten draft of this, which I worked from when I was writing the manuscript, completing the manuscript of the Song of Kwasan. But I did not have the full syllabary. I had a partial syllabary. So what's interesting is I had to go through, once I found his full syllabary, in addition to the essay, there were I believe, about 12 pages or so of actually listing all the syllables that could be used in the language. And the essay actually goes into how they can be combined and things like that. What are the rules for the language? And along with the each syllable was basically a glyph. So we have now the complete list of Kokarsan glyphs, which is quite fascinating. But it caused me a little trepidation because I had already finished the novel at this point. I had finished it in early 2008, and I realized that I had to go back and sync up a lot of the linguistics and language for some of the names that I had to provide that were not provided in Phil's outline. So I went back and did that, had some fun revising the manuscript to get it very, very authentically Kokarsan and authentically Formerian from that aspect. So,
yeah. Well, I remember the earlier novels, Hadden of Ancient Opar and Flight from Opar, right?
Flight to Opar.
But I remember, and they were terrific fantasy novels, very imaginative. He gave a lot of background, you know, as is very typical of Phil. He did his research, and you know, the other part that was interesting is that there is a connection there, both to other works of Phil's, Time's Last Gift in particular, and somewhat also to the Will Newton universe.
Yes. There's a character in the novels called Sahindar, who a lot of people equate with Tarzan. Phil has never come forward and fessed up that this character is actually Tarzan, but he did slyly indicate that this man was actually Grabardson from Time's Last Gift, whom Phil never identified as Tarzan, wink and a nod. But
right.
So, I'm sorry. What was your question?
Yeah. Well, no, just that you know, these were very fun stories, and that they actually fit into the larger body of work. You know, if you look at it, you can see it connecting into the Will Newton universe, connects back into Time's Last Gift, and into Phil's vision of human history. Because, of course, Sahindar becomes a witness to an awful lot of human history.
Yes. And in fact, he, you know, conceivably is the father of the Kokarsan civilization, because he traveled back in time and was ultimately responsible for actually some of the ancestry, in fact, of the Kokarsans, which creates an interesting thing, because normally you think of the Will Newton universe as this event that happened in 1795 with a meteor strike. And so you think, well, all the members of the Will Newton family have to actually be post-1795 to have inherited the genes, the mutated genes from the ionized radiation. But if Tarzan traveled back in time and founded the Kokarsan civilization, then if he did any interbreeding among them, then the Will Newton genes actually exist back, you know, 12,000 years ago. So,
right. Chris, we're all members of the Wold Newton family.
That's right.
There you go.
Because then the irradiation of those descendants get further irradiated when they're actually at Wold Newton in 1793, when it comes around again.
That's right. True.
Right.
Part of the myth is that, you know, isn't it, that some of these people who were there at the meteor site did have enhanced genes anyway, and that irradiation brought out something special. Yeah, so there are pre-descendants of, or, you know, pre-ancestors of the Wold Newton family, or people who were at the meteor site.
That's true, and Phil does say that the people who were there were already extraordinary.
Right.
Yeah, and maybe they were extraordinary because of this gene coming through Sahindar, maybe.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's some There's actually some interesting spoiler genealogy in Fell's notes about this, but it's nothing that I'd like to give away at this point. But there will be some of that in the Song of Kwasin when it actually sees print.
Wonderful. Well, I know you very generously let me take a look at the first couple of chapters a couple of years ago in our last con up in Peoria, and those first couple of chapters are a lot of fun, very well written, and you know, it has me wanting more. You know, if I remember correctly, at the very end of Flight to Opar is when La of Opar is born. I think I've got that right, don't I?
That's correct. Hadon, yeah. And Lalila's daughter, Lalila being, of course, from, I shouldn't say of course, but being from the H. Rider Haggard novel, Alan and the Ice Gods, ends up in the Opar novels and ends up getting together with Hadon. And their child is named Law. It's not the same Law that we all know from the Opar books. This is a Law of Phil Farmer's invention. But there's a prophecy in the book that she will be basically that she will found a dynasty that will last for a long, long, long time. So mm-hmm. that's where he's going with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's there were an awful lot of things, and that ties in with some of the Edgar Rice Burroughs references, and you have some of the H. Rider Haggard references. Mm-hmm. You know, it shows how complex Phil's writings really were, how he really envisioned them, and you know, as you said, the entire of human civilization now is tied back in to this group of Wold Newton heroes. Through for Gribbertson, whomever he might be.
Yes. I do want to say that the Song of Kwasin is actually not set in Opar or anywhere near Opar. It's actually set in that motherland that Phil created, Kokarsa. It's on the island of Kokarsa. And there's a lot of Haggard in the Song of Kwasin. There's a lot to do with the axe of victory, which was given from the dwarf Paga to Kwasin in the first book in Hadon of Ancient Opar. And it turns out that this axe is actually shows up in several H. Rider Haggard novels. It's the same axe of Umslapagas, the Zulu warrior. And Haggard, to a large extent, was showing the history of this axe, and what Phil did was wanted to go back and show the prehistory of it. Haggard had done a little bit of this in Alan and the Ice Gods, in which he showed Paga, who also later shows up in the Opar, ancient Opar novels. He shows Paga creating this axe, and the axe goes next to the hero Wi, spelled W-I, and it goes from Wi to back to Paga again, and then Paga delivers it to Kwasin. So Phil has mentioned in an interview that he actually meant for this axe to go from Kwasin then to Hadon's son, Kor. Note the name Kor. Kor is, of course, the founder eventually of the city of Kor, which was first introduced to the world in H. Rider Haggard's book She. So Phil was kind of filling in the pieces of the history of this axe, and that certainly comes into play in the Song of Kwasin.
Very good.
Hey Art, I would also point out that the history of the axe makes an appearance in some other works as well. And if you if you look up the chapter of the Evelyn Pemberley House that is set in the library at the estate Pemberley House, you might note that there was an appearance of the axe. How that might have happened, I have no idea, because the only time I ever speak with Chris is on these podcasts. But
interesting. You know, I have some recollection. I'm going to have to go back and look. So many levels.
You guys are king of Easter eggs.
Wynn and I actually collaborated on a story that has an interesting axe in it that may be of interest to people who've read both Haggard and the Kokarsa novels. It's called Iron and Bronze, and it was in Tales of the Shadowmen number 5, I believe.
Yes.
So that's an interesting other little tidbit. And other authors have actually done things with the axe as well. There was a story in that War of the Worlds anthology in which another author dealt with Slapagos's axe. Do you recall what that was, Wynn?
I can't remember the author, but the anthology you're referring to was edited by Kevin J. Anderson. It was called Hello. War of the Worlds Global Dispatches. And for the life of me, off the top of my head, I can't remember which writer. But I believe that M. Slapagos was in the title of the story.
Yeah, that was quite a few years ago. But that was a great collection.
It was. It was a very good collection for those who are crossover-minded like myself.
Oh, yeah. Well, Phil had a lot of other ideas that he'd been kicking around. I mean, you're in the book that was published in conjunction with PharmerCon, The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, Protean Dimensions. This was one that was published this year. All right, well, I'd ask now, we had, there were several other interesting ideas that Phil Farmer had, and one of them was in the book Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, Protean Dimensions. Your wife, Laura, had written an essay on an idea that Phil had, which is very, very fascinating. And would you like to talk a little about it?
Yeah. Phil, apparently, there's some paperwork that was found in the magic filing cabinet, which is basically correspondence relating to a novel that he referred to as a Mormon fantasy novel. Kind of in the vein of the Kokarsa books, he was thinking of writing a story set in prehistoric America, the prehistoric Americas, based on the premise that the book of what was said about prehistory in the Book of Mormon was literally true. It sounds like this would have taken place in an alternate universe, in that a character from our universe would have passed over into this other universe and also at the same time traveled back in time. And that's really about as much of the plot of the book that's available. A lot of the other correspondence goes into basically world building and fill some pages of research notes about books that he consulting to get like the various animals that were described in the Book of Mormon to get those to use for world building in his novel. So it's mostly correspondence between himself and Lester Del Rey. This was at the time he was working on, probably somewhere around the time he was working on Dark, well, probably right before he was working on Dark as the Sun, and around the time he was working on Up from the Bottomless Pit, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure. What's that? Laura's actually here in the room, and she's kind of prompting me because she's wrote the article.
Bring her on.
Yeah, Laura, come on, join the party.
Did you want to say something about it? She's making a face.
I guess I could talk about how I became involved in writing it, if you'd like.
Sure.
Chris had mentioned finding this, and I found it very interesting since I'm a former Mormon. I became intrigued by the idea, and I wanted to see what Farmer had written. And the more I read and the more I thought about, the more I was really... an article was already forming in my head, so I asked if it would be possible if I could write an article about it. I never thought it would get published. It was just a very intriguing idea for me to put, you know, ideas, you know, and words into form. So, and Chris liked it enough that he thought it would, you know, he'd like to, you know, see it in print. So that's kind of how that happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a wonderful article, and I was very intrigued by the whole idea. You know, it just is amazing to me what an imagination Phil had, that that he would go in that direction. You know, I would have loved to have seen what he did with it. You know,
right.
Because he would have treated all kinds of topics. You know, because in the story you'd have race topics are going to be part of it. There are going to be religious topics as part of it, and of course the various adventures. And you know, Phil always has his Farmerian hero, who comes into the world and is, you know, somewhat, shall we say, on his own as far as the mores of the world is concerned. You know, he's the hero, but by the same token, he's not a conformist. And
right.
That would be a very intriguing way that this kind of world, would be a perfect thing for Phil to let loose on. I really would have loved to have seen what he'd done with it. I thought your article was very, very nice, and it really had me intrigued. You know, as I had told Chris in a email, you know, it's a shame we only had 90 years with Phil.
Right,
Wish we had more. Imagine what he could have done.
That's a great quote, Art.
And what? Just one more thing on that. Laura points out in her article that there's a lot of similarities between this concept, this kind of alternate history, parallel universe novel, and the book Two Hawks from Earth, which recently was reprinted by Monkey Brain Books, which I had the honor of writing the afterword to, actually. But the protagonist of the Mormon fantasy novel would have been a Native American, which, you know, if you've read Two Hawks from Earth, obviously the same with that protagonist, and he was passing between parallel universes in much the same manner. So I found it, you know, interesting that, you know, Laura pointed out that it was really shortly thereafter that he launched into rewriting what was originally a book called The Gate of Time and retitling it as Two Hawks from Earth. It was pretty much right in the year or two following his correspondence about the Mormon fantasy novel that he decided to dig back into Two Hawks from Earth and represent it to the public. Mm. So I wondered if it, you know, could have stimulated his imagination there to get back into that project.
Mm.
Might have seemed like an easier way to tell that story since it was already half done, or more than half done, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder what... You know, we all kind of wonder why he didn't finish it, and how serious he was about it. He was corresponding over a fairly long period of a year or two about this this project, and it just kind of died. Of course, you know, he was working on several things in that period, including he was thinking of picking up the Kwasin novel, the third book in the Kokarsa series, was recontracted right around that time in 1979, if I have the facts right there. So he had so many things that he was working on, so many ideas as was very common with him, that I guess he just got railroaded by all the different ideas.
Oh yeah. I know that you just cannot do everything, and sometimes out of one grand project, you might get several smaller projects that kind of come out of them. You know, Two Hawks from Earth being one of them. Maybe some of the some of his other novels in the period also took some of that creative energy and he used it. It seems Phil didn't really waste any ideas. He recycled them when he could.
Yeah, in fact, he's come out blatantly and said that he, you know, you should never throw away your ideas. You should save everything because you can use it someday, you know. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, this brings us around to the book that was just published in accordance with the convention, The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, Freudian Dimensions. Yeah. So, Mike, did you want to say something about that? And I understand there may be plans for sequels, or at least more books in that series.
Yes, there are. Excuse me. There are definitely plans for more books in the series. You know, the Magic Filing Cabinet. Every time I go and open these boxes, just find new stuff I somehow haven't seen the first 17 times I look through them. But yeah, the first book, we're kind of trying to do a whole bunch of things with these books. One is preserving history. I discovered an article that Randall Garrett had written about Phil called The Bite of the Asp, which was Phil's original title for a story called The Biological Revolt, or that was published as The Biological Revolt. And this was the only story when Paul and I were working on Pearls from Peoria, he didn't want us to include, because the editor had destroyed the story, had just hacked it to bits, and the original manuscript is lost. So Phil was so unhappy with how that story turned out. And he had told me this years ago, and I kind of forgot about it. And then I found this article, and Randall Garrett goes into great detail, provides samples of Phil's original prose and what the editor had turned it into. And the editor, this was published in Science Fiction Plus, is the name of the magazine. And it was the last, I believe, science fiction magazine that Hugo Gernsback himself edited. And he's the one who hacked up the story and ruined Phil's story, basically. So we have history like that. We have, there's an article that was published in a local Peoria magazine where Phil talks about, it's called Philip Jose Farmer's Adventures in Hollywood, and it's about all the different screen treatments he'd written and all the movie options he had sold and how nothing had ever come of them. Because at the time, this was written before the first Riverworld, before sci-fi, you know, ruined Riverworld the first time. we're trying to preserve history and these things that, you know, if I hadn't found them in the files or learned about them online, nobody would know existed. So that's half of our goal. And the other half of our goal is there are so many authors today, so many science fiction authors writing today, writing through the 90s and the 80s, who are fans of Phil's and consider him a big influence. And I'm reaching out to these authors and trying to give them a unique opportunity where they can write a story based on one of Phil's characters or in one of his worlds. And we're really opening it up. You know, we're inviting people slowly. This isn't a call for submissions or anything. It is right now. It's by invitation only. But we hope to, you know, publish these books for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. What frequency are you looking at? Doing them in conjunction with the conventions?
I'm hoping to do one a year, but I'm not making any promises there because, you know, the vagaries of publishing, you just never know. This first book, as you said, it came out at FarmerCon. Thinking I was being a marketing genius, I told people they could pre-order the book, and I would take it to FarmerCon and get it signed by all the contributors who were there. All of them have been on the phone call, Chris and Laura and Wayne and Paul and myself. And, boy, what a lot of work that was. I just didn't think about the logistics of schlepping hundreds of books cross-country from Atlanta to Seattle, and then we had to all sit around and sign them. And I had also promised people we'd mail them right from Seattle, so I had to then box them all up and take them to the post office on Monday. So I don't think we'll be doing that again. The book will come out, and a month or two later we'll have FarmerCon, and if you happen to have the book and you bring it to FarmerCon, we'll sign it. Wherever FarmerCon happens to be, we haven't really started thinking about that yet. Because for years we did them in Peoria, obviously, because Phil and Betty were there. And this past year we did it in Seattle using the Locus Awards and the Science Fiction Hall of Fame inductions as sort of a backdrop. So there'd be other things for people to do there. People could go get books signed by Connie Willis and Ursula K. Le Guin and lots of other fine writers. And it wasn't just coming to see us for 3 hours. So hopefully we'll find different venues, different conventions that we can piggyback on and travel around the country. And this year lots of people came because it was in Seattle. They'd never traveled to Peoria and didn't think they ever would, but now suddenly we were in their back door or just a short train ride away. And so we saw people for the first time, people I've been emailing with for 10 years, but I've never met face-to-face. And so hopefully FarmerCon will travel around the country and we'll get to meet lots of people, and some we've sort of known online and some we haven't. Hopefully I can get all these guys, to Chris and Wynn and Paul, to travel to FarmerCon again, no matter where it is. That's the plan anyway.
Absolutely.
Very
definitely.
Good.
You know, this wasn't exactly a FarmerCon, getting a little off topic here, but last summer Wynn and I actually went to England and visited Paul and went to Wold Newton to see where the meteorite landed. And we went to the Natural History Museum.
Yep.
Paul can correct me if I'm wrong. And actually got to see the Wold Newton meteorite, which wasn't on display. It was down in the basement. Paul is relentless when he wants something. And he got us a little private viewing down there. And my wife and kids were with us, and Wynn's wife and was with us. And I don't think – was your wife and your daughters there?
Yeah, they were.
Why can't I remember that? But Paul and I were teasing our kids to make sure – get really close to the meteorite so the radiation will affect you and your children will part of the Wold Newton family and will be extraordinary. And my daughter still rolls her eyes when I tell that story. But
we got to hold bits as well, didn't we, which was quite nice. She had a little sliver that she passed around for us to – we had to wear gloves, but we got as close as we possibly could to it.
Yeah, we were actually able to touch a piece of the Wold Newton meteorite. It was amazing, having been a fan of that aspect of Phil's work for so long, to actually get to touch. And that's the neat thing about what Phil did, was he related so much of what he did to real events. So as Mike said, we also went to Wold Newton, which is up in the northeast of England in Yorkshire. And not only did we go there and visit the site where a monument was erected back in 1795 on the spot where it fell, but we also stayed overnight in the Wold Cottage, which was also in existence at that time period, and it's now a bed and breakfast. And we all had a wonderful evening there, great food, great wine, great conversation, and basically spent, you know, a full 24 hours in Wold Newton, England. It was amazing. We walked out to the meteor monument twice, once in the evening when we arrived, and then again as the sun was coming up the next morning. So it was very, it's an experience I'll never forget.
And we raised a glass to Phil, didn't we, while we were there as well?
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And speaking of Phil and how he incorporated history, if I can just interject, and Art, someday I'll blog about this and I'll actually post some photographs. But we took a road trip around England for 5 days, and the stop in Wold Newton was one of our stops. And as we were circling back around, heading south down from Windermere in the Lakes District, we stopped at a site called Sizer Castle. And in England, you can stop at National Trust sites, which are sort of like the national parks here. And if you have a pass, you can just go in for free to any National Trust site. So we got our passes for our trip and got year-long memberships. And we were just looking at a map and looking at our guidebook, and we were driving along and said, "Ooh, there's a castle. Let's pull over." Had no idea what we were in for. But Sizer Castle, we learned, was actually the domicile of Bess of Hardwick for a time. And we saw Bess of Hardwick's bedroom, which dates back to the 1500s. And Art, when I saw Bess of Hardwick's bedroom and the way it had been restored and the wood paneling and the artistry that went into the woodworking in there, I was immediately struck of the similarity to Bess of Pemberley's bedroom, as Phil described it in the Evelyn Pemberley House. And at this point, I'm just convinced, and I can't prove it, but I'm just convinced that on Phil's trip to England, that he saw some recreation, and the bedroom had actually not been restored when he was in England, but it had been recreated in one of the British museums, and I'm positive that he must have seen that and somehow have been inspired by some of that description.
Wow. What, isn't that interesting? Boy, you got some pictures too, didn't you?
Got some pictures. We actually have, I don't know, 10,000 pictures between us. So,
No. Let's not exaggerate. There was only 7,000 pictures.
Oh, only 7,000. All right.
Gotta love digital cameras with 8 gig cards and 4 people walking around with cameras taking pictures all day long. For 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks. 2.5 weeks, almost.
Oh, my gosh.
But so, yeah, trip of a lifetime.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. You know, you're going to have to blog about that. You're going to have to do that sometime. Now, when we were sitting around, when you guys were signing all those books, all those hundreds and hundreds of books, we had been discussing which ones of Phil's novels we thought needed to come back into print, or really I should say which ones of Phil's books that are out of print now needed to come back in. And do you remember that discussion?
Certainly. Certainly.
Certainly.
But it's all of them, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we were thinking of the top three. Do you recall which ones we had a consensus on?
I believe everyone had said Time's Last Gift was one of the top ones.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Okay. Certainly high on my list would be Doc Savage, His Apocalyptic Life. His biography or faux biography of Doc Savage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the other one, too, we talked about was the other log of Phileas Fogg.
Definitely.
Steampunk.
Yep. Yeah.
It's certainly one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. You know, and another, these, of course, are all kind of key books in the Wold Newton stories and in Phil's larger view of history. Now, the Doc Savage biography is interesting because unlike Tarzan Alive, which basically remained unchanged in all the editions other than the addition of some forewords here and there, recently, Bison Press, is it Bison Press?
Bison Books.
Bison Books, which is out of University of Nebraska, had republished, Tarzan Alive, when you had done, I believe it was a foreword for it, wasn't it?
Yes, I did the foreword for the new edition. I think that came out in 2006.
Right. And they included on that the a picture that Phil had wanted as the original cover for Tarzan Alive, but the publishers had overridden him and instead had gotten a very strange picture, very typical of the 70s and some of the artwork they had had. We talked about the Doc Savage book, on the other hand. With each new edition, Phil had made some modifications to the chronology of the stories, and I believe there were at least three different chronologies from him. Am I right?
I think there were at least two. There may have been three. Chris, do you recall?
I'm not sure. Yeah.
So I think he did revise the chronology from the hardcover to the softcover versions. And then there was a 1975 Bantam softcover.
Right.
There was an addition to that chronology. I'm not sure if I would go so far as to call it a full revision in the Playboy paperbacks edition, which came out a couple years later, and Phil had added an entry for the Red Spider, which was a previously unpublished Doc Savage novel by Lester Dent that was first saw print in the Bantam book series, never saw print in the original pulp series. And I'm not positive if Phil actually did any further revisions to the chronology in that Playboy edition. However, he did make some significant revisions to some aspects of the Wold Newton genealogy from the hardback to the softcover editions. And specifically, he had proposed originally, perhaps somewhat tongue-in-cheek, as was his wont, that the Shadow and G8 and the Spider were really all the same person and were different split personality aspects of the same human being. And I think he generated a lot of fan letters in opposition to that. And when he issued the revised paperback edition, he actually issued a revised genealogy and made the Shadow and G8 and the Spider half-brothers to each other. Mm-hmm. So left them in the same family, but changed the genealogy.
Yeah, he I was going to say he took that a different genealogy and he used that in his short novella, Adventure of the Peerless Peer, with Sherlock Holmes.
So yeah, that's a great point, Art, because the different characters, those different half brothers, do appear in the Adventure of the Peerless Peer. That's right. Mm-hmm. It's also probably a good to note that the British paperback edition of Doc Savage differs slightly from the American paperback versions in that it has an index, which I was thrilled to find out when I found a British edition of that book. And there were also a few slight text changes, at least I believe they're slight. I haven't done a full text comparison of the whole book, but I did find a few differences, which I actually noted in the chapbook to the Evil in Pemberley House. Terms of some of the heraldry, there was a slight text difference there. So if that book ever does come into print, it will be interesting to see how those different versions come together into a new publication.
In addition, I believe there's another change that he made, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he changed some of the details about how he imagined Doc Savage's final adventure would have been. Am I correct with that? When he described what happened, basically Doc's adventure after Up from Earth's Center. Do you know what I'm alluding to?
Well, I certainly know what you're alluding to in terms of the final Lester Dent novel, but I have to confess, I'd have to go and check the texts.
I believe he said, and I could be wrong here, but he included another pulp hero that would have gone and helped Doc in one of the versions, and he later cut that out.
Okay.
I'm blanking if it was... I could have sworn that the Shadow was involved in one of the editions, and then he cut that out in one of the other editions, one of the later...
So maybe that was in the paperback, or I'm sorry, in the hardback, and then maybe it was...
I believe it was in the hardback and then cut from the paperback. But
okay.
Anyway, I don't want to start rumors, so I probably should write an email.
No, well, but you know we're all going to be rushing for our books after this podcast.
That's right. Yeah, I have, you know, I've got copies of each one, except I don't have a Panther edition, the British edition one, but I've got it squirreled away somewhere in the library, and I'm going to have to go back and look. But that's interesting because the Doc Savage biography, we are coming up on the 80th anniversary of Doc Savage in 2013 when he began publishing. It would be nice to have the Doc Savage biography back in print for that. And, you know, under the circumstances with the different variations in the text, it would be nice to have a critical version that recognized some of those changes even in an appendix. And maybe have the different chronologies, you know, lined up so that people could see how Phil's thought had changed. You know,
it certainly would.
Yeah, that would really, well, as I'm one of those fans, I'm a terrible completist, and so I would love to have all that stuff. It would drive me crazy if we didn't. But
you also you may also remember from Farmer File 12, issue number 12, which I believe was the April 2008 issue. There was a short piece by Phil called John Gore in the Wold Newton Family, and again, from the Magic Filing Cabinet, we had actually discovered some typewritten text and a handwritten genealogy by Phil, where he had fit the hero, John Gore of the Lost Land, into the Wold Newton family tree. And for reasons unknown and that I'm sure we'll never know now, that piece of text and that aspect of the Wold Newton genealogy did not make it into the final published version.
Interesting. Well, we're good. See, there are still things yet to be published. You know, this brings back, while we're talking about Doc Savage, Phil had done his own pastiche of the Doc Savage character and the Tarzan character in... three stories, A Feast Unknown, The Mad Goblin, and Lord of the Trees, which were never published in hardback here in the U.S. They were in the U.K., and I was lucky to get a hold of those. But he had also announced in the early 80s a sequel to that. You know, he had his own characters, Doc Caliban, who was his Doc Savage alternative, his equivalent, and then the Lord Grunneth character, who was a Tarzan-like equivalent. In the story that he had planned to write, it was called The Monster on Hold. As I understand it, it was going to be a third story with Doc Caliban, and I think he was planning to also put in there some ideas as to what he thought actually happened to the Doc Savage character in Up From Earth Center, you know, giving his, because the story Up From Earth Center, we should, the fan base probably knows this, it was the last story published in the actual Doc Savage series, but it was not intended to be that, it just so happened to be that. And the basis of the story is that Doc Savage goes into underground caverns in Maine and basically comes on a Dante-esque scene with what appear to be souls in torment and demons, and he actually fights with the devil himself before he escapes. And the end of the story is kind of up in the air as to exactly what happened. Was this really hell? Was this some type of illusion? Is this some type of strange life form underground? It's never really resolved. And the Monster on Hold had been announced. He had actually... he read one of the chapters that he had written at a convention back in the 1980s. And didn't you reprint part of that in one of the collections too?
Yeah, in
actually,
Pearls.
Yeah.
Pearls from Peoria.
Yeah, you're right, Paul. Sorry, it was in Pearls from Peoria, and it was also in Myths for the Modern Age.
Yes, you're right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes, that's right. You know, that had all the makings of a very interesting story. And, you know, it's too bad that Phil had never gotten the opportunity to finish it. That's one of those that I would have liked to have seen done. But, well, you know, who knows what may come out of the filing cabinet? We have no idea. Maybe there's something lost there.
You mentioned the filing cabinet, and again, in Farmer File, and again, I think it was actually in that same issue 12 that I mentioned earlier, we printed an excerpt, or rather, all the excerpt that we found, three short chapters called Down to Earth Center. So playing off the Up from Earth Center title that you had mentioned of the last Doc Savage novel art. And again, this was a Doc Caliban sequel, much like the Monster on Hold chapter, but different text. So it would be interesting to see how the text from Down to Earth Center might fit into the outline for the Monster on Hold. Because if you recollect the Monster on Hold, Phil is basically giving an address at World Fantasy Con, I believe, 1983.
Right.
And as he's speaking, he's essentially outlining at least the first part or a substantial chunk of the book, The Monster on Hold. The actual written chapter that is then provided is occurs at least midway or even later in the book, by my estimation. And so then we find these other pieces of text down to Earth Center that were not originally included with that. And so it would be interesting to see how those might fit in to the overall Caliban sequel, if one were ever to be completed.
Interesting.
And you know, guys, we keep talking about Farmer File number 12. That happens to be the only issue that we are out of stock.
Of course.
Of course. You know, Farmer File ran from 2005 to 2009, and there was 15 issues, and we're not printing anymore. At least that's the plan for now, and probably that's it. We're not going to print anymore, and we're starting to run out, and issue 12 was the first one to sell out. I don't know if it's because it has Sherlock Holmes. Well, Phil has Sherlock Holmes on the cover. It's got one of our best covers, or what it was about it, but it's we no longer have any of those.
Maybe you'll find one on eBay someday.
That could be. I might want to buy it back.
Very good. Well, gosh, we've covered a lot of material. Is there anything that you guys would like to talk about? You know, Wynn, you have got some plans for sequels to Pemberley House, and there's another sequel out there for Myths of Modern Man.
Myths from the Modern Age, possibly. Yeah. And these are just ideas right now. Certainly, there's nothing firm in terms of sequels to Evil in Pemberley House. But it does end on something of a cliffhanger. It's pretty obviously set up for future books if the public demand is there for them. Sorry, Paul?
We demand. We do demand.
Yes, yes, then, absolutely.
Then your wish is my command. it's even possible that a sequel to The Evil in Pemberley House might somehow tie in with the Doc Caliban series, even though they appear to take place in different universes. But I will leave that at that. I've definitely been thinking about another Myths for the Modern Age collection, and every once in a while I'll come back and take a look at a proposed set of contents and dust that off. Nothing firm right now, but I would definitely like to pursue that again sometime in the future when the time is right.
Mm. Well, I know it's something that I would be looking forward to, and as Paul said, we want it, we demand it.
I'll give cracking.
We're the fan base.
I think that there's, you know, I've had farmer fans email me asking, you know, do you know, did Phil ever write any more of this? And, you know, I think that there's quite a demand among Phil's fans for seeing what happened in particularly in the Doc Caliban series, Doc Caliban Lord Grunith series. So yeah, I think that would be great, and also Pemberley House. Yeah, I think it's perfectly set up for a sequel. I would love to see it.
Absolutely. So.
Well, and I think that there's a lot of interest in that final Opar book. If that ever sees the light of day, I'm sure it's going to be gobbled up.
Yeah, well, things are going well with it. You know, the book is finished and things look very promising. That's about all I can say about it. But I think that the fans will be hearing about it in not too long.
Wonderful. Well, I know I've been waiting 30-some-odd years for this book, so, you know, I can wait a little bit more, but, you know, time is moving, guys.
Up there in the future, so, I mean, he can wait a lot longer.
As far as the Song of Kwasin, you know, if you need to, if there are fans out there that need to really need their fix, you know, I recommend that they pick up The Worlds of Philip as a Farmer, because I did have the opportunity to write a story, a Kokarsa story, in there. It's not directly tied in to the Song of Kwasin, but there are actually some linkages there that when the novel finally does see print, people will recognize them. So
absolutely, and just a great story to boot. You know, good storytelling is always, you know, the key. And then the linkages and the continuity, of course, you know, needs to be taken care of. But Chris is a great storyteller.
Oh yeah, it's a fun story, and I really enjoyed it. I loved the whole idea of that story. I saw a lot of myself in the scribe there.
But, yeah. For those who haven't yet picked up the book, the story is basically picking up where the character Hinokli is how you pronounce it in Kokarsan, or Hinokli, or what have you, who was Hadon's scribe from the first two books. He seems to die at one point. He just slips off of a ship and vanishes, and Hadon presumes him to be dead, and you hear no more of him. My story picks up from the point where Hinokli slips off the ship, and you find out what happened to him. So I'll leave it at that.
Very good. As long as we're talking about the contents of Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, and I'll keep it brief, but I'll take the opportunity to plug the origin of the Wold Newton Family series. And I think maybe a lot of people by now are at least passing familiar with the concept that, you know, there were people in a carriage passing by Wold Newton, the meteor lands, they get irradiated, and their descendants are these exceptional people from the land of fiction. But why were they there in the first place? Wold Newton is pretty far off the beaten path. What were these extraordinary people doing way up in Wold Newton, England, on December 13th, 1795, anyway? So my story basically kicks that off, and there's a potential for a series there. We should also probably plug the website for Meteor House.
Yes.
MeteorHousePress.com is where the book can be ordered. And last but not least, Paul, we haven't really heard from you about your Time Distorter story, which I thought was just a ton of fun. So maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd absolutely love to. Well, I think, I mean, the history of the Time Distorter story, or stories, there are two now, go back to the other lot, the Phileas Fogg that Art mentioned, that we talked about when we were in Seattle. And, you know, I was intrigued, and I'm sure many people were intrigued by probably, well, the last sentence in the book, where he says that Phileas Fogg's initials and your editor's are the same is, I assure you, only a coincidence. And I, you know, I think that was a clue that Phileas Fogg is Phil Farmer. And certainly in the Tor edition of the book, the illustrations of Phileas Fogg look like Phil Farmer. I certainly picked up on that as a clue that, you know, there was a connection between Phil and Phileas Fogg. And I wrote a story for, well, PharmaCon 90, I think it was, called The Time Distorter, which premise was that, you know, Phil was an Eridanian agent, and anybody who's read the epilogue of Phileas Fogg will know that the background to that story is the battle that's going on between the Eridanians and the Capellians on Earth for control. And in the epilogue of Phileas Fogg, you know, Phil interweaves his story with the Jules Verne story around the world in 80 days. And I took that forward in the Time Distorted story and explained how Phil did actually become Phileas Fogg, and by dint of that became part of the Wald Newton family, which is something that something of a challenge that Phil threw out himself, you know, to people to say, you know, prove that I'm in the Wald Newton family. And Wynn did that in a piece of his creative mythology in one of the Farmer File editions. And so Time Distorter, originally in a PharmaCon booklet, then I expanded it in Farmer File 15, the last Farmer File that we did. And in Protean Dimensions, I've have another Time Distorter story called Le Maréchal, which is an adventure that Phil takes back to medieval England. It's not on a mission for the Eridanians or anything. It's purely a historical visit for Phil. He originally wants to go and see Eleanor of Aquitaine, somebody he admires, but things go slightly awry, and he ends up spending time with William Marshall, who to him is a minor character, somebody he's read about but doesn't really know a lot about. But William Marshall was very important in English history. He was around the time of King John. He was regent of England. He was there when the Magna Carta was signed. And in fact, Phil, in my story, is the writer of one of the most important poems of that time, L'Histoire de Guillaume de Marshall, which talks about the life of William Marshall. And so now we have a lot more information about that time period and about William Marshall. It was actually Phil who was involved in that. And I also hint that William Marshall is somebody that we, as Phil Farmer scholars, would recognise as a character, even though Phil himself at that time doesn't recognise him. And I hope that if I do further stories, that I will bring that out. And the idea is that Phil undertakes, hopefully, many adventures, and he uses those experiences to influence his writing. So, you know, Phil wrote about King John in the Riverworld series, and so he had first-hand experience of King John, and that's why he could talk about him in a more balanced way, you know, acknowledging his great faults, but also trying to put it in context of the age he lived in, because, in theory, Phil was there as well. And, you know, I had great fun writing it, and I'm, you know, just, you know, over the moon that, you know, we can talk about Phil as being in the Wald Newton family and can have these adventures. And Art, you talked about us only having 90 years of Phil, but to me, we had, you know, we only had 90 years in our timeline, but I strongly believe that Phil lived many more years than that in these adventures in the past.
You know, and isn't that an interesting idea where the author creates the characters and we are now seeing him brought back into being a character himself in his own universe.
Absolutely. That's
a new kind of immortality.
Yeah.
If there's time, I should probably mention, give just a little bit more detail about some of the other stories, some of the other fiction that's in the book.
Yes.
Actually reprinted a story called Infamy by a writer named Edward Morris, which is just, it's almost hard to describe, but well, it started with the same idea Phil had. What if William Burroughs, instead of Edgar Rice Burroughs, wrote Tarzan? So he had this idea independently, and as soon as he pitched it to somebody, they said, well, Phil Farmer did that in the 60s. So he had to go read Phil's story, which was very different than his, and he actually got in touch with Phil, and Phil gave him permission to write the story, and it was published in a magazine that's since gone out of print, out of business. So he allowed us to reprint it. It's a great, really neat story, very almost through the looking glass, a very twisted parallel universe kind of story. There's a story called The Pollinators by Reese Hughes, which is set in the world Phil created for The Lovers. Actually, on Earth, not the story where The Lovers takes place, which is a really fun story. No Trees of Earth is a story by David Bischoff, set in the world of Tears. So we get to see Jadowin and Chrysis and Kickaha again. Flesh Endures is a story by Dennis Power, one of the great Wold Newton scholars, along with Wynn, which is clearly set in the world of flesh, but also set in another world that Phil wrote about, and I'm not going to say which one. We'll leave that as a surprise. And finally, to kind of close out the book, we have The Final Flight of Greatheart Silver by Chris Roberson, a writer that we were very thrilled to get in the book. And hopefully I didn't miss anybody. Somebody grab me if I did. I do believe that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was going to say, the book is a fun collection of history and imagination. There's an original story by Phil that was also unpublished. There are lots of little tidbits in there that I think people will appreciate. You know, and just the great imagination and the skill that Phil put into his work. Now, I'm still amazed at how meticulous he was in creating his worlds. The story he has in there about how he went about creating the idea for I'm forgetting the name. Sail On is the story, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, Phil's story. A fascinating tale about trying to set up an alternative universe and just how hard that is and how you got to think it through. So it's a wonderful collection. Phil Farmer fans will enjoy it very much. I have to say, Wynn, I loved your story there with the Scarlet Pimpernel. It really sets the tone and it explains why they were there at Wold Newton. And well,
thanks, Art. Thanks.
Yeah, I really like that. And really all the stuff in there, you know, Laura's essay, Chris's story, the various pieces. You know, I noticed there was the interview there with Danny Adams, where he mentions in the interview, Phil is talking to him and mentions, there's this website in Georgia. And we know that was your website, but he just kind of said, I've been looking at this website in Georgia. So those were early days, and it's a shame that Phil's no longer with us, but his work lives on, and these imaginative stories. I love what Paul has done with these time distorted stories because they do give us some more background, and I have to say, very farmer-esque in the way you do it too, Paul, which I think is a great compliment.
It is. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, I know we've been on for quite some time, and I know it's getting later for some of us and earlier for others.
Yeah, the sun is just starting to rise. Actually, it's starting to get light.
So I think we're about to close out. Is there? I'm going to open it to our guests. Anything else that we need to discuss, or anything you want to remind us about? Remember. As we've often said, shameless plugs are the reason why we're here. So anything else of interest, this is the time.
Okay, this is when, shameless plug very quickly, Crossovers 1 and 2, A Secret Chronology of the World, now out from Black Coat Press. Heavily influenced by Phil Farmer's work. So please check that out. And Art, I just want to thank you and Rick for taking the time and hosting us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hey,
we appreciate you guys. We appreciate your being on the show. I know how hard it is to get you four guys together. And, you know, Paul, you're a real trooper because you're 6 hours ahead of us. And we appreciate you coming on. You know, you guys are some of the nicest guys, you know, that I know. It's always a pleasure to be around you guys. And I've appreciated the fact that you have been so open. You know, you've included me in so many of your things. And, well, you know, I think you're doing a wonderful thing here, you know, keeping Phil Farmer's legacy alive. He was a great man. I know there's one last thing I wanted to put in just before the show goes out. We were there for the Grandmaster Ceremony where they had the Science Fiction Hall of Fame is actually in Seattle. It is housed in the same building with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And in the museum there, they had several books from different authors. They had first editions. And there were at least three of those books that were Phil Farmer's books that were up in the museum itself. Phil has not yet been included as an inductee to the Hall of Fame. But I note with interest that not only did he have three books in the science fiction part of the Hall of Fame, but actually one of his books is very noticeable in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In the exhibit on Jimi Hendrix, we find they used to have an actual book, The Night of Light, open to the page, but for reasons that are not clear, they now just have a cover. And they've got a recording which talks about how Phil Farmer's book, The Night of Light, which I believe was a Hugo winner, was influential.
Just a nominee, I believe.
Just a nominee? Too bad, it should have won. But it was the book that encouraged and inspired Jimi Hendrix to do his album Purple Haze and the title song. In fact, the word Purple Haze, the very words themselves are, I believe it's on page 47 of the Berkeley edition, which is what they mention in the recording. So Phil Farmer is mentioned, he's present at least three times in the Science Fiction Museum and once in the Rock and Roll Museum. You know, one of these days he needs to be honored as well, you know, as an inductee in the Hall of Fame. And I would like to see that happen.
Absolutely. I'm a resident of the Seattle area, and I go down there a lot to the Science Fiction Museum and the EMP, which is the Experience Music Project, which is the music side of the museum. And one whole side of the building is covered in, it's a very unique architectural design. It's covered in purple glass, this purple, it's not glass actually, but purple reflective surface that looks like a purple mirror. And that's obviously a tribute to Jimi Hendrix and Purple Haze, but when you think about it, the entire side of that building was designed, you know, off of an idea that was inspired from Philip as a Farmer, you know. And then to find him not in the Hall of Fame yet is rather puzzling.
Yes. It is. It is puzzling, and we heartily agree with you, Art, that he should be in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I will point out, since you brought up Night of Light, that it is still in print. It's in the Subterranean Press edition of The Other in the Mirror. So if you want to read that story, it's out there.
There you go.
Yes, and it is an excellent story. It was part of his John Carmody series, and it was actually the second book of Phil's that I read. Yeah, After a Feast Unknown. So, which is a heck of a first book. Okay.
Yes, well, it is.
Yeah, but anyway, I would like to thank the Four Horsemen of PharmerCon for coming on the show. We really appreciate it, and we wish you all luck. Please keep us posted on developments. We'll keep our eyes on the PJ Farmer website. What's the address for that again, Mike?
It is pjfarmer.com and meteorhousepress.com.
Very good. And we'll keep our eyes on it. And I guess that's going to close us out for this edition of the Book Cave. This is Art Sippo.
And Rick Croxton.
And all the boys from PharmaCon. Wishing you all a pleasant evening. Thank you for coming.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Very well. See you next year, Art.
Absolutely.